Chapter 3. The details of the L disaster, and I do not mean elevated in the beau milieu of last century, which had the singular effect of both causing and cursing the notion of Terra, are too well known historically, and too obscene spiritually to be treated at length in a book addressed to young laymen and leemans, and not to grave men or gravemen. Of course, today, after great anti-L years of reactionary delusion have gone by, more or less, and our sleek little machines, Farragod bless them, hum again after a fashion, as they did in the first half of the 19th century, the mere geographic aspect of the affair possesses its redeeming comic side, like those patterns of brass marquetry and bric-a-brac, and the ormolu horrors that meant art to our humorless forefathers. For indeed, none can deny the presence of something highly ludicrous in the very configurations that were solemnly purported to represent a varicolored map of Terra. Ved, it is, isn't it, side-splitting to imagine that Russia, instead of being a quaint synonym of Estoti, the American province extending from the Arctic, no longer vicious circle to the United States proper, was on Terra, the name of a country, transferred as if by some sleight of land across the ha-ha of a doubled ocean to the opposite hemisphere, where it sprawled over all of today's Tartary, from Curland to the Kuriles. But even more absurdly, if in terrestrial spatial terms, the Amarussia of Abraham Milton was split into its components, with tangible water and ice separating the political rather than poetical notions of America and Russia, a more complicated and even more preposterous discrepancy arose in regard to time. Not only because the history of each part of the amalgam did not quite match the history of each counterpart in its discrete condition, but because a gap of up to 100 years, one way or another, existed between the two Earths, a gap marked by a bizarre confusion of directional signs at the crossroads of passing time, with not all the no-longers of one world corresponding to the not-yets of the other. It was, owing, among other things, to this scientifically ungraspable concourse of divergences that minds bien rangés, not apt to unhobble hobgoblins, rejected Terra as a fad or a phantom, and deranged minds, ready to plunge into any abyss, accepted it in support and token of their own irrationality. As von Wien himself was to find out, at the time of his passionate research in terology, then a branch of psychiatry, even the deepest thinkers, the purest philosophers, Parr of Chose and Zapater of Aardvark, were emotionally divided in their attitude toward the possibility that there existed a distortive glass of our distorted glebe, as a scholar who desires to remain unnamed has put it with such euphonic wit. Kaveri, kaveri, as poor Mademoiselle L. used to say to Gavronsky. In Ada's hand. There were those who maintained that the discrepancies and false overlappings between the two worlds were too numerous and too deeply woven into the skein of successive events not to taint with trite fancy the theory of essential sameness. And there were those who retorted that the dissimilarities only confirmed the live organic reality pertaining to the other world, that a perfect likeness would rather suggest a specular and hence speculatory phenomenon, and that two chess games with identical openings and identical end moves might ramify in an infinite number of variations on one board and in two brains at any middle stage of their irrevocably converging development. The modest narrator has to remind the rereader of all this because in April, my favorite month, 1869, by no means a mirabilic year, on St. George's Day, according to Mademoiselle La Riviere's maudlin memoirs, Demand Wien married Aqua Durmanoff, out of spite and pity, a not unusual blend. Was there some additional spice? Marina, with perverse vainglory, used to affirm in bed that de Man's senses must have been influenced by a queer sort of incestuous, whatever that term means, pleasure, in the sense of the French plaisir, which works up a lot of supplementary spinal vibrato, when he fondled and savored and delicately parted and defiled in unmentionable but fascinating ways flesh, in chair, that was both that of his wife and that of his mistress, the blended and brightened charms of twin peris, an aquamarina both single and double, a mirage in an emirate, a germinate gem, an orgy of epithelial alliterations. Actually, Aqua was less pretty and far more dotty than Marina. During her 14 years of miserable marriage, she spent a broken series of steadily increasing sojourns in sanatoriums. A small map of the European part of the British Commonwealth, say from Scandinavia to the Riviera, Altar and Palermontovia, as well as most of the USA from Estati and Kennedy to Argentina, might be quite thickly prickled with enameled Red Cross flag pins, marking in her War of the Worlds Aqua's bivouacs. She had plans at one time to seek a modicum of health. Just a little grayishness, please, instead of the solid black, in such Anglo-American protectorates as the Balkans and Indias, and might even have tried the two southern continents that thrive under our joint dominion. Of course, Tartary, an independent inferno, which at the time spread from the Baltic and Black Seas to the Pacific Ocean, was touristically unavailable. Though Yalta and Alton Tog sounded strangely attractive. But her real destination was Terra the Fair, and thither she trusted she would fly on libellula long wings when she died. Her poor little letters from the homes of madness to her husband were sometimes signed Madame Shichim Yashuchich Zukov. Heart-rending sounds. After her first battle with insanity at Aix-en-Valais, she returned to America and suffered a bad defeat in the days when Vaughn was still being suckled by a very young wet nurse, almost a child, Ruby Black, born Black, who was to go mad too. For no sooner did all the fond, all the frail, come into close contact with him, as later Lucette did, to give another example, then they were bound to know anguish and calamity, unless strengthened by a strain of his father's demon blood. Aqua was not quite 20 when the exaltation of her nature had begun to reveal a morbid trend. Chronologically, the initial stage of her mental illness coincided with the first decade of the Great Revelation, and although she might have found just as easily another theme for her delusion, statistics showed that the great, and to some intolerable, revelation caused more insanity in the world than even an over-preoccupation with religion had in medieval times. Revelation can be more perilous than revolution. Sick minds identified the notion of a Terra planet with that of another world. And this other world got confused not only with the next world, but with the real world in us and beyond us. Our enchanters, our demons, are noble iridescent creatures with translucent talons and mightily beating wings. But in the 1860s, the new believers urged one to imagine a sphere where our splendid friends had been utterly degraded, had become nothing but vicious monsters, disgusting devils, with the black scrota of carnivora and the fangs of serpents, revilers and tormentors of female souls, while on the opposite side of the cosmic lane a rainbow mist of angelic spirits, inhabitants of sweet Terra, restored all the stalest but still potent myths of old creeds, with rearrangement for melodeon of all the cacophonies of all the divinities and divines ever spawned in the marshes of this, our sufficient world. Sufficient for your purpose, Vaughn, entendons-nous. Note in the margin. Poor Aqua, whose fancies were apt to fall for all the fangles of cranks and Christians, envisaged vividly a minor hymnist's paradise, A future America of alabaster buildings 100 stories high, resembling a beautiful furniture store crammed with tall, whitewashed wardrobes and shorter fridges. She saw giant flying sharks with lateral eyes taking barely one night to carry pilgrims through black ether across an entire continent from dark to shining sea, before booming back to Seattle or Wark. She heard magic music boxes talking and singing, drowning the terror of thought, uplifting the lift girl, riding down with the miner, praising beauty and godliness, the Virgin and Venus, in the dwellings of the lonely and the poor. The unmentionable magnetic power denounced by evil lawmakers in this, our shabby country, though everywhere in Astati and Kennedy, in German Mark Kennensee, as well as in Swedish Manitoboggan, in the workshop of the red-shirted Yukonets, as well as in the kitchen of the red-kerchiefed Yaskanka, and in French Astati from Brass Door to Lador, and very soon throughout both our Americas and all over the other stunned continents, was used on Terra as freely as water and air, as Bibles and brooms. Two or three centuries earlier, she might have been just another consumable witch. In her erratic student years, Aqua had left fashionable Brown Hill College, founded by one of her less reputable ancestors, to participate, as was also fashionable, in some social improvement project or another in the Severnia Territorii. She organized with Milton Abraham's invaluable help a free pharmacy in Belokonsk and fell grievously in love there with a married man, who, after one summer of parvenu passion, dispensed to her in his camping Ford Garçonnière, preferred to give her up rather than run the risk of endangering his social situation in a Philistine town where businessmen played golf on Sundays and belonged to lodges. The dreadful sickness, roughly diagnosed in her case and in that of other unfortunate people as an extreme form of mystical mania, combined with existalienation, otherwise plain madness, crept over her by degrees, with intervals of ecstatic peace, with skipped areas of precarious sanity, with sudden dreams of eternity certainty, which grew ever rarer and briefer. After her death in 1883, Vaughan computed that in the course of 13 years, counting every presumed moment of presence, counting the dismal visits to her various hospitals, as well as her sudden tumultuous appearances in the middle of the night, wrestling with her husband or the frail but agile English governess all the way upstairs, wildly welcomed by the old Appenzeller, and finally making the nursery, wigless, slipperless, with bloodied fingernails, he had actually seen her, or been near her, all in all, for a length of time hardly exceeding that of human gestation. The rosy remoteness of Terra was soon veiled for her by direful mists. Her disintegration went down a shaft of phases, every one more racking than the last, for the human brain can become the best torture house of all those it has invented, established, and used in millions of years, in millions of lands, on millions of howling creatures. She developed a morbid sensitivity to the language of tap water, which echoes sometimes, much as the bloodstream does, predormitarily, a fragment of human speech lingering in one's ears while one washes one's hands after cocktails with strangers. Upon first noticing this immediate, sustained, and in her case rather eager and mocking, but really quite harmless replay of this or that recent discourse, she felt tickled at the thought that she, poor Aqua, had accidentally hit upon such a simple method of recording and transmitting speech, while technologists, the so-called eggheads, all over the world were trying to make publicly utile and commercially rewarding the extremely elaborate and still very expensive hydrodynamic telephones and other miserable gadgets that were to replace those that had gone Tritium Sobachim, Russian to the devil, with the banning of an unmentionable lammer. Soon, however, the rhythmically perfect but verbally rather blurred volubility of faucets began to acquire too much pertinent sense. The purity of the running water's enunciation grew in proportion to the nuisance it made of itself. It spoke soon after she had listened or been exposed to somebody talking, not necessarily to her, forcibly and expressively. A person with a rapid, characteristic voice and very individual or very foreign phrasal intonations, some compulsive narrator's patter at a horrible party, or a liquid soliloquy in a tedious play, or Van's lovely voice, or a bit of poetry heard at a lecture, my lad, my pretty, my love, take pity, but especially the more fluid and flu Italian verse. For instance, that ditty recited between knee-knocking and palpebra-lifting by a half-Russian, half-dotty old doctor, doc, toc, ditty, dotty, balletta, deboletta, two, voce spignotita, spigoty and diavoletta, de lo cor dolente, con balletta va, va, della struta, destrutamente, mente, mente. Stop that record, or the god will go on demonstrating, as he did this very morning in Florence, a silly pillar commemorating, he said, the elmo that broke into leaf when they carried stone-heavy dead Saint Zeus by it through the gradual, gradual shade. Or the Arlington Herodin talking incessantly to her silent husband as the vineyards sped by. And even in the tunnel, they can't do this to you. You tell them, Jack Black. You just tell them. Bathwater or shower was too much of a Caliban to speak distinctly, or perhaps was too brutally anxious to emit the hot torrent and get rid of the infernal ardor to bother about small talk. But the burbly flowlets grew more and more ambitious and odious, and when at her first home, she heard one of the most hateful of the visiting doctors, the Cavalcanti quoter, garrulously pour hateful instructions in Russian-lapped German into her hateful bidet, she decided to stop turning on tap water altogether. But that phase elapsed too. Other excruciations replaced her namesake's loquacious quells so completely that when, during a lucid interval, she happened to open with her weak little hand a lavabo cock for a drink of water, the tepid lymph replied in its own lingo, without a trace of trickery or mimicry, finito. It was now the forming of soft black pits, yami yamishichi, in her mind between the dimming sculptures of thought and recollection that tormented her phenomenally. Mental panic and physical pain joined black ruby hands, one making her pray for sanity, the other plead for death. Man-made objects lost their significance or grew monstrous connotations. Clothes hangers were really the shoulders of decapitated Tellurians. The folds of a blanket she had kicked off her bed looked back at her mournfully with a sty on one drooping eyelid and dreary reproof in the limp twist of a livid lip. The effort to comprehend the information conveyed somehow to people of genius by the hands of a timepiece or piece of time became as hopeless as trying to make out the sign language of a secret society, or the Chinese chant of that young student with a non-Chinese guitar whom she had known at the time she or her sister had given birth to a mauve baby. But her madness, the majesty of her madness, still retained a mad queen's pathetic coquetry. You know, doctor, I think I'll need glasses soon. I don't know. Lofty laugh. I just can't make out what my wristwatch says. For heaven's sake, tell me what it says. Ah, 4:30. For what? Never mind. Never mind. Never and mind are twins. I have a twin sister and a twin son. I know you want to examine my pudendron, the hairy alpine rose in her album, collected 10 years ago. Showing her 10 fingers gleefully, proudly. 10 is 10. Then the anguish increased to unendurable massivity and nightmare dimensions, making her scream and vomit. She wanted and was allowed, bless the hospital barber, Bob Bean, to have her dark curls shaved to an aquamarine prickle, because they grew into her porous skull and curled inside. Jigsaw pieces of sky or wall came apart, no matter how delicately put together. But a careless jolt or a nurse's elbow can disturb so easily those lightweight fragments which became incomprehensible blanks of anonymous objects, or the blank backs of Scrabble counters, which she could not turn over sunny side up because her hands had been tied by a male nurse with Demand's black eyes. But presently panic and pain, like a pair of children in a boisterous game, emitted one last shriek of laughter and ran away to manipulate each other behind a bush, as in Count Tolstoy's Anna Karenin, a novel. And again, for a while, a little while, all was quiet in the house, and their mother had the same first name as hers had. At one time, Aqua believed that a stillborn male infant, half a year old, a surprised little fetus, a fish of rubber that she had produced in her bath, in a lieu de naissance plainly marked X in her dreams, after skiing at full pulver into a larch stump, had somehow been saved and brought to her at the Noose House, with her sister's compliments, wrapped up in blood-soaked cotton wool, but perfectly alive and healthy, to be registered as her son, Ivan Veen. At other moments, she felt convinced that the child was her sister's, born out of wedlock, during an exhausting yet highly romantic blizzard in a mountain refuge on Sex, Skex, Rouge, where a Dr. Alpiner, general practitioner and gentian lover, sat providentially waiting near a rude red stove for his boots to dry. Some confusion ensued less than 2 years later, September 1871, her proud brain still retained dozens of dates, when upon escaping from her next refuge and somehow reaching her husband's unforgettable country house, imitate a foreigner, "Signor conductor, I want go Lago di Luga, yer gelt." She took advantage of his being massaged in the solarium, tiptoed into their former bedroom, and experienced a delicious shock. Her talc powder, in a half-full glass container marked colorfully Quelquefleur, still stood on her bedside table. Her favorite flame-colored nightgown lay rumpled on the bed rug. To her it meant that only a brief black nightmare had obliterated the radiant fact of her having slept with her husband all along, ever since Shakespeare's birthday on a green rainy day. But for most other people, alas, it meant that Marina, after G.A. Vronsky, the movie man, had left Marina for another long-lashed Christosik, as he called all pretty starlets, had conceived. C'est bien le cas de la dire. The brilliant idea of having Demond divorce Mad Aqua and marry Marina, who thought, happily and correctly, she was pregnant again. Marina had spent a Rukuliru Yushichi month with him at Kitej. But when she smugly divulged her intentions, just before Aqua's arrival, he threw her out of the house. Still later, on the last short lap of a useless existence, Aqua scrapped all those ambiguous recollections and found herself reading and rereading, busily, blissfully, her son's letters in a luxurious sanatoria at Centaur, Arizona. He invariably wrote in French, calling her Petite Maman, and describing the amusing school he would be living at after his 13th birthday. She heard his voice through the nightly tinnitus of her new, planful, last insomnias, and it consoled her. He called her usually Mamie or Mama, accenting the last syllable in English and the first in Russian. Somebody had said that triplets and heraldic dracunculi often occurred in trilingual families, but there was absolutely no doubt whatsoever now, except perhaps in hateful, long-dead Marina's hell-dwelling mind, that Van was her, Aqua's, beloved son. Being unwilling to suffer another relapse after this blessed state of perfect mental repose, but knowing it could not last, she did what another patient had done in distant France at a much less radiant and easygoing home. A Dr. Froide, one of the administerial centaurs who may have been an émigré brother with a passport-changed name of the Dr. Froit of Signy Mondrieux Mondrieux in the Ardennes, or, more likely, the same man, because they both came from Vienne, Isère, and were only sons, as her son was, evolved, or rather revived, the therapistic device aimed at establishing a group feeling of having the finest patients help the staff, if thusly inclined. Aqua, in her turn, repeated exactly clever Eleanor Bonvar's trick, namely opting for the making of beds and the cleaning of glass shelves. The Astorium in St. Taurus, or whatever it was called. Who cares? One forgets little things very fast when afloat in infinite non-thingness. Was perhaps more modern, with a more refined desertic view than the Montfroid Bleak House Hospital, but in both places, a demented patient could outwit in one snap an imbecile pedant. In less than a week, Aqua had accumulated more than 200 tablets of different potency. She knew most of them, the jejune sedatives and the ones that knocked you out from 8 p.m. till midnight, and several varieties of superior soporifics that left you with limpid limbs and a leaden head after 8 hours of non-being, and a drug which was in itself delightful, but a little lethal if combined with a draught of the cleansing fluid commercially known as Morona, and a plump purple pill reminding her, she had to laugh, of those with which the little gypsy enchantress in the Spanish tale, dear to Lador schoolgirls, puts to sleep all the sportsmen and all their bloodhounds at the opening of the hunting season. Lest some busybody resurrect her in the middle of the float-away process, Aqua reckoned she must procure for herself a maximum period of undisturbed stupor elsewhere than in a glass house, and the carrying out of that second part of the project was simplified and encouraged by another agent or double of the Isère professor, a Dr. Sieg Heiler, whom everybody venerated as a great guy and near genius, in the usual sense of near beer. Such patients who proved by certain twitchings of the eyelids and other semi-private parts under the control of medical students that Sieg, a slightly deformed but not unhandsome old boy, was in the process of being dreamt of as a papa fig, spanker of girls' bottoms and spunky spittoon user, were assumed to be on the way to haleness and permitted, upon awakening, to participate in normal outdoor activities such as picnics. Sly Aqua twitched, simulated a yawn, opened her light blue eyes, with those startlingly contrasty jet-black pupils that Dolly, her mother, also had, put on yellow slacks and a black bolero, walked through a little pine wood, thumbed a ride with a Mexican truck, found a suitable gulch in the chaparral, and there, after writing a short note, began placidly eating from her cupped palm the multicolored contents of her handbag. Like any Russian country girl, Lako mya shichayasya yagodami, feasting on berries that she had just picked in the woods. She smiled, dreamily enjoying the thought, rather Karenin in tone, that her extinction would affect people about as deeply as the abrupt, mysterious, never-explained demise of a comic strip in a Sunday paper one had been taking for years. It was her last smile. She was discovered much sooner, but had also died much faster than expected, and the observant Sigi, still in his baggy khaki shorts, reported that Sister Aqua, as for some reason they all called her, lay, as if buried prehistorically, in a fetus in utero position, a comment that seemed relevant to his students, as it may be to mine. Her last note, found on her and addressed to her husband and son, might have come from the sanest person on this or that earth. Aujourd'hui, haute toity, I, this eye-rolling toy, have earned the psychic right to enjoy a land party with Herr Dr. Sieg, Nurse Joan the Terrible, and several patients in the neighboring boar, Piney Wood, where I noticed exactly the same skunk-like squirrels, Van, that your dark blue ancestor imported to Artist Park, where you will ramble one day, no doubt. The hands of a clock, even when out of order, must know and let the dumbest little watch know where they stand. Otherwise, neither is a dial, but only a white face with a trick mustache. Similarly, Chelebek, human being, must know where he stands and let others know. Otherwise, he is not even a clock piece of a Chelebek, neither a he nor she, but a tit of it, as poor Ruby, my little Van, used to say of her scanty right breast. I, poor Princess Lointain, très lointain by now, do not know where I stand. Hence I must fall. So adieu, my dear, dear son, and farewell, poor Demon. I do not know the date or the season, but it is a reasonably and no doubt seasonably fair day, with a lot of cute little ants queuing to get at my pretty pills. Signed, my sister's sister, who tepper is Ada, now is out of hell. If we want life's sundial to show its hand, commented Van, developing the metaphor in the Rose Garden of Ardis Manor at the end of August, 1884, we must always remember that the strength, the dignity, the delight of man is to spite and despise the shadows and stars that hide their secrets from us. Only the ridiculous power of pain made her surrender. And I often think it would have been so much more plausible, aesthetically, ecstatically, estotially speaking, if she were really my mother.